I think we have a quorum, and so we might as well get to the business of the day, which is, and we have a first item then will be approval of the minutes. We have, how many, three sets? We have three sets of minutes here, if I can find the date on this thing. One for January 17th, one for January 16th, and one for the 15th. So, if you have those in front of you, and we can have Representative Rosenthal move adoption of the minutes, all three. Everybody, that's a little overburdened, I know, when we start out with three sets, but everybody take a quick look, and you can't find anything wrong with them, because mostly because we didn't do much, but that's all right. No objections one way or the other, so we will move to a vote. All in favor, please signify by aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Minutes are adopted. And the next thing on the agenda is we have House Research with us. Now, I don't know if was there anybody that heard this morning. We're going to have the same. It wouldn't hurt to hear it again, if you know what I mean. But if you don't want to, you don't have to. Except, huh?
I slept through the first half this morning.
Okay. Well, you sleep through the second half this afternoon, so. Okay, we have with us today Matt Burris, who's House Research, the nonpartisan House Research Department, and Andy Lee from House Fiscal Analysis, nonpartisan. I don't think those guys are partisan. You're not partisan either. Okay. So we get an unbiased opinion of whatever they're going to say. So, Matt, would you like to start out, please?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. Again, I'm Matt Burris with the nonpartisan, neutral, and non-advocacy House Research, and I'm joined with Andy Lee of the similarly nonpartisan House Fiscal. I was asked by the chair to provide a overview of transportation finance, as well as give the committee some sense for the purview of the transportation policy issue area, broadly speaking. Most of the focus here is on the transportation finance structure, and actually I'll bring up the contents. Most of the focus is on finance components, with a little bit of discussion of the budgetary accounts under the purview of the Transportation Finance Committee, and then some policy themes that have come up in past years in the transportation policy world. To start with the finance, I'd like to actually talk first about the structure of streets and highways, because that's quite linked to the finance structure. The state has a trunk highway system. That's the interstate system, as well as other major and arterial regional connectors throughout the state. That's maintained by the Department of Transportation. And then counties, cities, and towns all have jurisdiction over their respective roadways. So counties construct and maintain their and plow and so forth their county highways. Similarly with cities and municipal streets, and towns with town roads. And there's a couple of sources of state aid for the local systems. And those are expressed through the county state aid highway system and the municipal state aid street system. Each of those are a subset of the roads maintained by the counties and cities respectively. So just a portion of all county highways are on the county state aid highway system, and same thing with the municipal streets. At a high level, the highway system I think is best described as being a combination of constitutional requirements and statutory requirements. So the framework is largely driven by the Constitution, but it is also sort of flushed out, if you will, by statutes. Another important characteristic of highway, again, we're on highway finance. On highway finance at a general level, is that there's very little in the way of general fund appropriations, and that's the spending authority that's provided to state agencies. And for the most part, in the transportation finance world, the vast majority of general fund spending comes for transit and some components of the Department of Public Safety. Another just high-level aspect of the transportation funding is funding for local road systems, and that's through a combination of the federal and state as well as local revenue streams. There are three core sources that comprise the vast majority of the highway revenues. Those we'll talk about in turns: the motor fuels tax, or the gas tax, registration tax, and MVES, or motor vehicle sales tax. The motor fuels tax is taxed at a rate of 28.5 cents per gallon. That's the current rate that's in effect for this fiscal year and all future fiscal years, barring any law changes. That's the rate that is imposed on gas and diesel. There are other fuel types, and the rates are also set in law for those based on the energy content proportional to this 28.5 cents per gallon rate. The 28.5 cents per gallon is actually has two parts to it. One is 25 cents, the other is a 3.5 cent debt service surcharge. That amount is authorized at a variable rate depending on trunk highway bonds that have been issued. The kind of policy rationale expressed is to cover part of the debt service to repay some bonds. And we'll circle back around to the bonding discussion a little bit later. A portion of the revenues from the motor fuels tax go towards non-transportation. The revenues are attributed to non-highway uses. So the concept or rationale is that some part of the fuel used or fuel purchases are for snowmobiles, watercraft, ATV, and those revenues are transferred into Department of Natural Resources accounts. So you might see in some sheets DNR transfers. That's what it refers to as here. But apart from that, the funding stream from the motor fuels tax is under the Constitution set only to go to highways, streets and highways.
Mr. Bruce, the variability part, the 3.5, is governed by the amount of outstanding debt. Is that how we govern?
Mr. Chair, yes. Yeah, it's the outstanding debt on trunk highway bonds. 3.5 cents per gallon is the maximum allowable rate. And it would scale down depending on the bond, the debt service necessary on bonds that have been issued.
Well, once that's come into being, though, it doesn't go down until the debt load is reduced by how much? Is there any scale on that, or did you know of?
Mr. Chair, I have not seen specific numbers on that recently. I think it's fair to say that it will be on the order of a couple of decades before,
yes,
with the current bond issuances that have taken place, it'll be a couple of decades before this rate would drop down from the 3.5 cent.
That's what I thought. So I just wanted to make that clear.
Yeah, a number of bonds have been, you're stealing my thunder for a future slide, but a number of bonds have been issued in recent years, and so the rate scaled up to 3.5, yeah, and is set to stay there for some time.
Thank you.
There was legislation in 2008 that increased the tax and phased it in over a number of years, and this table contains the phase-in process. As I mentioned, for fiscal year 2013, which is our current fiscal year, and all subsequent fiscal years from here going forward in time, the rate is set at 28.5 cents per gallon.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Representative Ronbeck.
While we're on that point, Mr. Burris, then how much will that raise?
What is the total?
What? Use your mic, will you please?
I did.
What was the question?
How much will the 2.85 in 2013 raise total tax raised, total tax revenue?
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, we'll actually get to some of the budgetary numbers a little bit later, but the motor fuels taxes for 2013 are forecasted to be at about $875 million just for that year.
Thank you.
I'll be attempting in a couple of future slides to kind of give a little sense of the scale of these revenue streams.
Thank you.
The second major funding source is the registration tax, also referred to as tab fees. This is an annual tax. It's imposed on motor vehicles that are operated within the state. And it is imposed for passenger automobiles at a percentage of the original value of the vehicle. And that percentage at 1.25% is set. But as the vehicle gets older, there's a depreciation schedule that's in place so that older vehicles are required to pay a smaller tax as they get older. There's also a minimum and a different schedule in place for other types of motor vehicles, particularly trucks and buses have other schedules and adjustments. All of the revenue from the registration tax is dedicated to the highway system. The third major funding source is the motor vehicle sales tax. This is a percentage tax, and the rate is set at 6.5%. And it's imposed on new and used motor vehicle sales. There was a constitutional amendment in 2006 that was passed by the voters that dedicated all of the revenues from the motor vehicle sales tax, or MVEST, to transportation purposes, and it included a phase-in. There are also limitations placed within this constitutional amendment, and it placed a ceiling on the amount of the revenues that could go towards highways, as well as a floor on the amount that could go towards transit, or a minimum that had to go towards transit from the revenues. Prior to the constitutional amendment, MVEST had periodically been partially provided towards transportation purposes and partially deposited into the general fund and used for general fund type purposes, and there were a number of changes over preceding years and decades in the allocations of MVEST revenues.
That was, I just a little historical perspective, that was my bill in 2005 that passed. Was a comprehensive transportation bill, and the governor vetoed it, but this was a constitutional amendment, the MVEST movement, and he couldn't veto that, so it became, after the transportation community who wanted extra money, and why we put the massive bill forth in the first place. Am I doing that, or would that soften with one of these things? I guess I'm doing it. That's all right. Transportation community raised money then to have that. It was on the ballot in 2006. We passed it in 2005. In 2006, it was on the ballot, and it was successfully passed. And then the MVEST transfer started. I just want you to know that, so I thought I'd mention it. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair and members, the constitutional amendment sets the basic requirements, and then the actual allocation of funds between highways and transit is set by statute. And there's a phase-in and some shifts to the allocation formula over the course of the phase-in, but starting in fiscal 12 and also for future fiscal years, the allocation is 60% highways, 40% transit, or 36 more specifically to the metropolitan area, and 4% to Greater Minnesota Transit. So when you hear 60, 36, 4, this is probably what's being discussed. There are some other revenue sources that feed into the highway system. The largest one is federal aid. Again, we'll get to dollars a little bit later. There are some very small general fund appropriations. There are also funding streams that go into the trunk highway system, so the state system of interstates and major highways. from a couple of sources related to agency type operations and sale of goods and services and permitting and so forth. And then another revenue source is the motor vehicle lease sales tax. This is a sales tax on leasing as opposed to vehicle sales. A portion that those funds go towards go into the general fund, and a portion is allocated to roads in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. This chart provides a quick summary with preliminary and now outdated, I'm sorry to say, numbers of state and federal highway funding. The numbers have shifted some with the release of very recent release of some financial statements, but this hopefully gives you a sense of the basic scale of the funding streams. The next slide gets at the similar information, looking only at the state sources of funding, so you can hopefully get a sense of the relative magnitude of the three funding sources and a sense of their weights compared to all the other state funding sources. Another component of the highway financing structure is bonding, and it's a revenue source, but it's an odd one in that bonds are debt financing. The funds are available when bonds are sold, and so in a sense it's revenue for that fiscal year, but because it's debt, the debt service, the principal and the interest on the bonds must be repaid in future years. That 3.5 cents per gallon on the gas tax gets at that repayment aspect for bonds. Bonds are a function of the legislative process. The legislature enacts bills that authorize issuance of the bonds and appropriates the proceeds from those bond sales to particular projects or programs and so forth. And in the transportation world, there's an important distinction in types of bonds, and that is between trunk highway bonds and other general obligation bonds. All of these bonds are a form of general obligation of the state, so the state is obligated to pay them back. But trunk highway bonds have a constitutional distinction. They're separate under the structure of the Constitution and how it's been interpreted. And so trunk highway bonds are only for use on the trunk highway system, whereas GO bonds, as they're called, are not available for use on trunk highways. Some of the recent uses of trunk highway bonds that have been authorized over the past few years, past decades really, are basic road construction, so maintaining and expanding the trunk highway system and bridges, particularly bridges. There are a couple of new programs that have been funded through trunk highway bonds, and traditionally in capital investment or in transportation finance legislation, there are specific MnDOT facilities that have been funded through trunk highway bonds, and that's sort of been the historical tendency or trend. And trunk highway bonds have been authorized in both transportation finance legislation as well as in the bonding bill, capital investment bills. GO bonds have been used for a variety of different types of projects in different areas, including transportation. And in the transportation world, have been used to fund both programs and specific projects. Local road improvement program, local bridge replacement and rehabilitation are a couple of the major projects, program types that have received bond funds that are then administered through MnDOT. And there's also been a number of particular projects that have been funded through GO bonds and capital investment bills. Some recent examples include the Central Corridor, past the light rail, other rail airport projects.
Mr. Burris, I think we should make clear to everybody that to satisfy the debt service on the trunk highway bonds, The money has to come out of the highway user trust funds. And that's why we have to see that the flow of money into the highway user trust fund, which is coming from a variety of sources, the major one, which is the gas tax. We want to continue to issue bonds, because I think we're almost at the debt limit now, within $100 million or something like that. We have to increase the flows of money into the highway trust fund. Otherwise, the money for bonds is not there because the debt service is set at a certain limit. And it can only come, those bonds have got to be issued and debt service out of the highway user trust fund. That's the distinction between those and general obligations.
Mr. Chair, with just one clarification to that, it's the trunk highway fund that the debt service on trunk highway bonds is paid out of. So that is that's the fund that supports trunk highway bonds.
Okay.
And the general fund is the fund used to support general obligation bonds. This chart shows a slice, if you will, of the finance structure, and it's kind of only the first half. We'll get to some additional pieces in a future slide. So this is on the revenue side and the flow into the trunk highway fund coming from federal aid and some of those comparatively more minor sources, and then the core revenue funding sources flowing into the highway user tax distribution fund, which brings us to a discussion of what the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund is, or HETD. This is a constitutional fund, and it's one of several that are established in the Constitution as part of the framework for transportation finance. And it is the recipient of the dedicated funds for highways. And it's also the distribution point out to the state and local highway systems. Along with the HUTD, there are three core funds. All of these are, by the way, separate from the general fund. They're sort of equivalent, but these are all just in existence under the Constitution for the transportation finance world. These three core funds are the Trunk Highway Fund for the state system, the County State Aid Highway Fund for the county system, and finally the Municipal State Aid Street Fund for the city system. From the state aid funds, so the county state aid and municipal state aid funds, there are allocations out made administered by MnDOT and following some statutory formulas for generally on a proportional basis providing the funds to counties in the case of the CASA or County State Aid Highway Fund, and providing the funds to cities in the case of the Municipal State Aid Street Fund. There are several components to the formulas, and essentially is driven by the relative weight that each county has in each of the formula parts. A couple other aspects of distribution of the revenue. So as I mentioned, the revenue is distributed from the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund into those three highway funds following a constitutional set of requirements. One of the constitutional pieces is that there are two parts to the distribution. The first part is called the 95%, because 95% of the funds are allocated out under this formula, which is 62-29-9. 62% to the Trunk Highway Fund, 29% to counties, or the county state aid system, and 9% to the Municipal State Aid Street System. So it goes HUTD, collects all the revenue. From there, 95% is allocated under this 62-29-9 formula. The other 5% is referred to as the 5% set aside, and that can be allocated, again, following the constitutional requirements, to any of those three core highway funds. That's a formula that can only change every 6 years, and changed as part of the significant large-scale 2008 transportation finance legislation, and is currently set to go to town roads, town bridges, and a flexible highway account. And that flexible highway account portion is a combination of things. It's administered by MnDOT. A large portion of it goes towards turnbacks, which is the process of where the city or the a city or a county agrees, enters into an agreement with MnDOT to turn over jurisdiction of a portion of the trunk highway system to then become part of the county state aid system or the municipal state aid system. And that this funds upgrades to those roads as part of that turnback process. There are also a couple of legislative priorities and some funds to local roads under the flexible highway account. This chart is a recap of the distribution flow. It's kind of the second half of the basic highway finance structure. Again, these are preliminary numbers for fiscal year 2012 and have shifted some. And actually, Mr. Lee will be touching on a couple of documents a little bit later in the presentation that have some more updated number values. The second area in the transportation finance world to discuss is transit, and past presentations have provided a little bit of overview, but just to touch on it, transit operations are done at the local government level. In the Twin Cities area, that's the largest transit provider is the Metropolitan Council. There are also several suburban providers and some other independent providers. And then there's a variety of different types of transit operations throughout greater Minnesota at the city level, county level, multi-county levels. Both MnDOT and the Metropolitan Council have roles in transit, and they have some commonalities in that both agencies do general policy making, future planning, administering various pots of federal funds, providing assistance to transit providers. The basic distinction is that the Metropolitan Council has general purview over the Twin Cities metropolitan area and is also a transit operator in addition to being a planning type agency. And then MnDOT provides assistance to transit providers throughout greater Minnesota. In the greater Minnesota transit funding, there are several layers or levels of funding sources from the federal, state, to the local level. In terms of state sources, the general fund is one of the key ones. The motor vehicle lease sales tax is another funding source that was touched on, I think, a bit earlier. And the motor vehicle sales tax, again, this is the constitutionally dedicated to transportation purposes. 4% of the motor vehicle sales tax revenue goes towards greater Minnesota transit. And historically, traditionally, some amount of general obligation bonds have been provided for transit facilities. And then fare box recovery revenue coming from fares comprises another funding source for transit. In the Twin Cities metropolitan area, there are some of the parallel sources. Again, federal aid, a general fund appropriation, motor vehicle sales tax allocation, fare box recovery again. There are a couple of additional sources. One is the sales tax, which is at a rate of 0.25% and is administered by CTIB. Saw a presentation on that previously. And then property taxes comprises another component, and that's levy authority that the Metropolitan Council receives through legislation. This is a overview of funding from state sources, and again highlights the basic amounts and sources of state assistance for transit.
Mr. Burns, I wanted to mention something about fare box recovery. I guess the questions I heard were from the Finance Committee, and I didn't say anything at that time, but surprisingly as it seems, no transit system in the United States and possibly in the world makes its money completely out of fare box. It's always a percentage. So when the Met Council says that the Hiawatha Light Rail Line is producing fare box recovery at close to 40%, I think that's, and it's one of the leading ones in the country, if not the leading ones. They're giving you a very good report on that line, and on the, I don't remember what their figure was on the total system, but it just isn't done. And there's other reasons for having transit than just to make money. Unfortunately, that's be the case no matter wherever you see a transit system. So I just thought I'd mention that so that we dispel that we're going to be have a moneymaker when we have a transit bus or rail or whatever. Thank you.
And then, Mr. Chair, rounding out transportation finance, aeronautics is another significant piece from a funding and formulas standpoint. The state has a state airports fund, and this is another user fee dedicated revenues type of structure for aeronautics. And the state airports fund supports both aid to airports as well as MnDOT's aeronautics office, which provides various forms of technical assistance and aeronautics programming. That fund is funded through three revenue sources that, in a sense, parallel the highway sources. One is a fuel tax that's on aviation fuel at a variety of rates depending on the amount of fuel purchased. The second is a registration tax on aircraft registration, and the third is a property tax on commercial aircrafts and equipment. There are some other modes that are funded through a typical transportation finance bill, and the funding sources include the general fund, it's again, it's appropriations made in the bill, and GO bonds, often for particular projects and some programs.
Representative Sundin, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Burris, in regards to slide 31, it points out a sliding scale from 5 to 0.5 cents per gallon. Can you give us a history lesson on the aviation fuel, why it's on a sliding scale when the other rates and for the motor fuels tax are fixed? A little history lesson on that?
Mr. Burris?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sundin, I'm not sure of the history. I think a little bit of the rationale comes from the amount of fuel being purchased by different users of the aviation system. So commercial airlines use just an incredibly vast amount of fuel in comparison to, you know, a private airplane owner. And so the per gallon rate on most of the fuel that's purchased by for commercial purposes is quite a bit lower than the per gallon rate purchased for private use, simply because private users don't use as much fuel. But as to history, I'd have to get back to you on more detail behind that.
Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, is there any way to calculate exactly how much more funding we could derive if we had a set rate at 5% instead of the sliding scale?
That's Mr. Burris?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sundin, yes, we can put together a model for you. And then, Mr. Chair and members, one other area that is a part of the transportation finance world is the Department of Public Safety. A typical transportation finance budget includes funding for components, some divisions within the department, not the entire department. It's sort of an agency that's shared across multiple legislative committees. One area that's funded is the State Patrol, who's core function is patrolling highways and includes commercial vehicle enforcement efforts. They patrol the trunk highways. I'd like to clarify that. So they're funded through from the trunk highway fund. Part of the state patrol includes capital security, and that's funded through the general fund. These are just basically straight up appropriations as part of each transportation finance budget. Another division within the department is driver and vehicle services, or DVS. They're a fee-based operation, so the fees imposed for the type of administrative work they do is what provides the funding source for their continued operations. DVS does, their duties include driver licensing, motor vehicle registration. They collect the registration tax, license plates, titles, and there are a couple of operating accounts that most of the fee revenue goes into and is then appropriated back out of for their agency operations. Just to circle back around then and recap some of the key points on the transportation finance structure, it's both constitutional and statutory, so there are some elements that would require a constitutional change in order to modify things. There are three basic, it's kind of a story of threes, there are three core basic funding sources, and those funds go via a couple different types of formulas into three highway funds. And on the highway side, there's very little general fund dollars. And as a proportion of the overall transportation budget, general fund is pretty small. So from this, one can see both flexibility and limitation, particularly with the constitutional aspects. The dedicated transportation funding has some implications for the ease of making finance and policy changes, and the constitutional nature of some of the distribution can also, in a sense, protects or sets aside transportation funds from what happens to the general fund on a biennial basis, but there are also sort of more restrictions in the ease with which changes can be made. A lot of changes require constitutional amendments to be adopted in order to shift some of the finance structure around. And that, Mr. Chair, brings us to the next piece of the presentation, which is on budgets and a couple of the documents that highlight that are in your save folder and highlight committee accounts and jurisdiction. And I'll just briefly mention that in your save folder there are a number of reference type sheets. There are a couple of write-ups that provide some similar overview as this presentation, and a couple of other reference materials, a glossary, as well as a kind of visual allocation quick reference sheet.
And Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Andrew Lee from House Fiscal Staff, and I'll be walking you through some of the basic spreadsheets. You'll see in your save folder one spreadsheet that's titled Minnesota House Transportation Finance Committee Account General Fund Only. That's the portion of the committee that has jurisdiction over, the portion of the general fund that the Transportation Finance Committee has jurisdiction over. And I think we have a slide here. You can see the relative size of the general fund that the Transportation Finance Committee has jurisdiction over relative to transportation funds. So most of the transportation funds are, you know, invest, tab fees, gas tax generated, and are constitutionally dedicated. Mr. Chair and members, that is better. I will say that you're also the beneficiaries of slightly larger print with regard to the spreadsheets. The morning committee had a little bit of a harder time reading some of these spreadsheets. If you look at the general fund only spreadsheet, you'll see a breakdown of the general fund spending for transportation finance. The top And it breaks out the current biennium, and for new members, the state budgets in two-year bienniums, and so there's an allocation for 1 year, an allocation for second year, and then a biennial total. And you see the current biennium that we're in is 2012 and 2013, and then the planning base, and that was the number set in 2011 when the 2012-2013 biennium was enacted, and so this is kind of the numbers that they set planning at for this biennium that the legislature will be budgeting for this session. And then on the right side, you'll see the governor's recommendation for transportation general fund, and this is new as of yesterday. And on the far right, you'll see a column explaining the differences in from the governor's recommendation to the base. And if I could just highlight a few points, in the Department of Transportation, multimodal systems refers to the vast bulk of that is Greater Minnesota Transit. There's a few other components in there, but that's most of it. State roads, as you can see, is a very, very small amount, $3,000 a year, and then it goes up to $10 million a year in the governor's recommendation, and that is a result of Transportation Economic Development Program, in which is administered by MnDOT and DEED, and I believe that existed in this biennium, in which businesses and locals can compete for funds that would say, a business would want an improvement to an intersection, and that's kind of what these funds are for. And then on Metropolitan Council Transit, this is the general fund money that goes to the Metropolitan Council for transit operations, bus, rail, and metro mobility, in addition to the suburban transit providers. And so this is a portion of the money that comes in from the state, but this is only the general fund portion. The rest is from the motor vehicle sales tax from the invest, that 40%. And you'll see in the current biennium, the level is set at $39 million a year for Metropolitan Council, and then in the base, it goes up to 46 or almost $45 million a year. And the governor's recommendation, it's lower than the base at $41 million a year, for the 14-15 biennium. And then the Department of Public Safety, the first line, administration and related services, that's a lot of various miscellaneous items. I think there's a police body armor repayment program, a few odds and ends, and then State Patrol, that's the portion of State Patrol that is capital security, that about $3 million a year in the current and the base budgets. So, and one more thing that I'd like to highlight in the bottom line, this number will the total amount is when is the number that will have to conform to the target when a target is set for the Transportation Finance Committee. Whatever bills come out of policy or finance will have to either meet that target or be below it, at least as the House passes its bill. Moving on to the next spreadsheet, this one has a little bit smaller text. This is a summary of the transportation funds, and you can see the top spreadsheet is the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. I won't spend too much time on this, but it's just the basic numbers, the forecast for 13 and going on. And below is the Transit Assistance Fund, and this is where you can see the revenue generated from motor vehicle sales tax and how it's distributed to the Metropolitan Council and the Department of Transportation. And the final spreadsheet is the airports fund, and I'll make one note on this. The airports fund is not constitutionally dedicated, so
okay. Mr. Chair and members, that brings us to a discussion of the policy world a little bit. And what I hope to do here is give the committee a little sense of the kinds of themes and policy discussions that have taken place in recent years in transportation. This is intended as a high-level overview, as kind of examples, general themes, and so I don't intend this as a prediction of any sort.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Runbeck?
Before we leave the funding, could you tell me the quarter cent sales tax that's raised for transit, what that raises annually, and is that the tax that the governor has proposed to basically double then?
Mr. Lee?
Chair, Representative Runbeck, that is a local option tax that is levied in five metro counties. Mm-hmm. I think it's with the exception of Carver and Scott, and that raises approximately $100 million a year from those five counties. And I still think there are some questions on how exactly the new quarter cent sales tax would work with that, if it would be contributed to that fund or if it would be separately managed by Metropolitan Council, or how that would be distributed.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, then, agency operations is a pretty broad concept, but there are quite a few policy areas within that. And this theme deals with the basic structure of the agencies, the administration, staffing, policies and procedures, and extends to MnDOT, the Metropolitan Council, divisions within the Department of Public Safety, so the four agencies that receive state funding. But it also impacts local units of government somewhat more indirectly. Operations issues extend into decision-making processes, the highway construction process, maintenance, contracting questions, pavement design, use of different pavement types. Historically, there have been a fair number of legislative reports that have been requested, and some of those are annual, some are one-time reports that and planning efforts that agencies have been asked to develop. Another area under the purview of the policy committee is, broadly speaking, looking at the planning and the programming processes for development and maintenance of highways and transit, particularly transitways. Programming is one of those terms in the business, referring to actually identifying the funding and committing to using those funds towards particular projects. And issues around that have ranged from the selection, how particular highway projects get chosen, or how particular transitway development gets selected in the first place, what the steps are in that development process, the types of contracting methods used to hire private contractors to actually do construction work. Another area that has come out somewhat more recently is complete streets, which is a concept of looking somewhat more holistically when streets and roadways are being reconstructed or worked on, looking at all of the users of the street or the roadway. So it's largely, but not exclusively, bringing in considerations of ADA compliance, pedestrians, alternative users of the roads and that right of way, bicycles and so forth. This chart provides a quick summary of some of the key planning documents that MnDOT creates on a annual or every few year cycle. The first one is known as the STIP. It's the State Transportation Improvement Program, and this is a listing of, for 4 years, all of the planned state or federally funded construction projects. It's just a very long list. But those are that's the MnDOT set of project commitments. And looking longer term, MnDOT has some actually a variety of different planning and policy development documents. And the Highway Investment Plan, the Multimodal Transportation Plan are a couple of the examples of key planning type documents. Another area of policy discussion is licensing drivers. And this ranges from the driver's education process, the identification card itself that's produced and what goes on that card, to graduated driver licensing, which is a system of staged increasing privileges for drivers, for new drivers, particularly those who are under age 18. And the structure behind that has been a area of legislative change in recent years. Driver licensing, as I mentioned earlier, is under the purview of Driver Vehicle Services. But it's also implemented or administered through a hybrid system that is a combination of cities, counties, and DVS. And a lot of the offices spread throughout the state are actually county driver licensing agents that actually perform. Those are the offices where you go to get your license updated. They work under the purview of the Driver and Vehicle Services in the Department of Public Safety. Vehicles is the other side to licenses, and this is an area dealing with registration of the vehicles, titling, the tax collection process, license plates and special plates, which are non-standard plates that are legislatively authorized and have historically been authorized for a variety of different types. Some of those are plates where an additional donation is provided and that revenue stream funds particular programs or grants. Again, Driver and Vehicle Services administers license plates and vehicle registration and so forth. And similar to driver's license agents on the driver licensing side, on the vehicle side, there's a hybrid system of DVS and local units of government, as well as private deputy registrars, private office providers for registration services. Another theme is traffic regulation and traffic safety issues. This ranges from definition and restrictions and requirements on particular vehicles and identifying types of vehicles to driving, rules of the road, speed limits, traffic safety requirements around driver distraction or messaging while driving. There's a number of provisions on towing and the timing of when a tow can be required. Traffic enforcement practices. This is one of those spots that connects with or impacts local units of government. A lot of the core traffic regulations are set by the state and cannot be modified by local units of government. And so they're the same rules of the road apply everywhere. Minnesota doesn't have a 12 and a half mile an hour speed limit, by the way. I just saw that and thought it was funny. Another area is commercial vehicle regulations. And this is a complex area. I'll touch on it just to note that there are a bunch of components. There are quite a few aspects to the regulatory structure. And it is a combination of both federal requirements that are placed on interstate commerce and similar, but in some cases not the same, state requirements for intrastate commerce. A large degree of the federal requirements are incorporated by reference, so that they apply the same way at the state level, but there are other exceptions for when commercial vehicles are being operated solely within the state. Exceptions and modifications, I should say. Another area in the commercial vehicle world are truck sizes and weights, and that regulatory structure is divided into a couple of different parts. One is a basic set of limits on the dimensions of motor vehicles, so height, width, length. Another is a set of limits on the weight that a motor vehicle can bear, and it's not just the overall gross vehicle weight, but also weight based on each axle, each of the possible combinations of axle groupings, wheels, and so forth. There's a huge, complex, scary-looking table in statutes that lays all of this out. There are also a number of adjustments to the weights and special permits that MnDOT, as well as local units of government, can issue to go over the standard weight limit, depending on requirements of each permit. Administration is through both MnDOT and state and local law enforcement. Another area in the commercial vehicle regulation world is rail safety. It's been discussed in the past. I'll briefly touch on pupil transportation, primarily to note that there is a regulatory structure for transporting students that is separate from the commercial vehicle regulatory structure. There are a number of similarities, and the basic types of regulations around drivers, around vehicles, and inspections are parallel, but it is a separate set of regulations. Enforcement here primarily resides in the State Patrol. There's an office that for pupil transportation that was created through legislation. There are a number of programs for state assistance to local units of government. These are often funded through GO bonds in past years. And I just listed out a few examples of those. And there are a variety of different kind of policy questions and possible areas of legislative discussion around those programs. These are all set up in state statute, in other words. And so it is under the authority of the legislature to modify things like eligibility criteria or permissible uses of funds and so forth. Agency initiatives also come up in assistance programs world. And that's, I think, actually where the Transportation Economic Development Program came more out of agency discretion and some of the funds that have been appropriated to them and sort of combining up different funding sources to create a program. So we've covered a fair amount of high-level territory in the themes, and I wanted to note that a number of the issue areas actually overlap with other committees, and this really comes into effect when you've got a specific bill and might move through the committee process to a number of different spots. But just to mention, administrative rulemaking is a common theme across all committees. Administrative rules are used by agencies to set up another like kind of aspect of laws and requirements. Auto insurance has typically been dealt with primarily in the commerce type committee. Criminal law crosses across both transportation and the public safety world. DWI, impaired driving, has typically been dealt with more in the public safety committees. Local government agency operations and governance questions have been addressed in both transportation as well as a local government committee or government operations type committee. And pupil transportation is often a kind of shared issue area that cuts across committees. If there are any further questions, I'd be happy to jot them down and answer them at some point if I don't know them now.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Burris, just in the area of laws regarding automobiles on the highway, is it a new law that says if there's a traffic, public safety, state highway patrolman on the right-hand side dealing with a car, that the drivers are supposed to leave that first lane of traffic and move to the outer lane of traffic? Or is that just common courtesy or practice? Or do you know what I mean?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck. That law, there is a move over law that's been in place for a number of years for law enforcement personnel, and it's gotten some discussion because it's been expanded a bit to apply to other types of vehicles in the last couple of years. And the basic requirement is to shift over a lane if it's safe to do so. But it's not just law enforcement, and I can get you the statutory citation and more detail if you want.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Burris, is it punishable by a fine, if you don't observe it? I mean, how strictly is it being enforced?
Mr. Burris, you know, you may have an answer, but I think tomorrow morning driver services are going to be here, mm-hmm. and they would have specific answers on that. But if you have an answer, fine.
I don't, Mr. Chair, I don't have a definitive answer. I would note that in general, not all the time, but in general, traffic violations carry a petty misdemeanor penalty. So that's no criminal, it's not quite a crime, it's no jail time, and there's a limit to the fine amount. I'm not sure with that specific one. It doesn't ring a bell as being something carrying mm-hmm. a higher penalty. So I suspect that it's a petty misdemeanor, but I don't know for sure.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you.
Any other questions? Yes.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Burris, what's an e-bike?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mason, an e-bike is an electric assisted bicycle.
Okay.
There was a change made to quite a bit of the regulations on e-bikes last year, enacted by the legislature last year, and now e-bikes are essentially treated to be a subset of bicycles. It's a bicycle that has a small electric motor that provides assisted propelling, if you will. So it looks a lot like a bicycle, but it has this kind of add-on motor to help with hills or when a bike operator gets tired.
Okay, thank you.
Anything else? Well, it's a little ahead of time, and might as well. Some of you have been taking naps, but now you get a chance for a little bit of a nap between now and your next meeting. So I think we'll adjourn. How's that sound? Everybody okay with that? Adjourned. And we're going to have a joint committee meeting tomorrow morning.